And I should be able to hear something on the headset from KSEO. Now, do I? I don't.
Don't hear
it. I don't. Test, test, test. Test, test, test. No, I don't. I don't hear myself. I see myself, but I don't hear myself. What?
You don't hear yourself, really?
Test, test, test. Nope, 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 nope. Nope, 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 nope. Now, what did you push? What was the secret?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if you can hear yourself now or not.
Here. Weird, weird.
No, this goes like this. You just pull it out like that.
Okay.
There you go. Now, put that on your head and see if you can hear
Hi,
yourself.
Hi, Dave. We're over here.
All right. Hi, Dave.
Okay, I hear myself now. Billy, what button did you push?
I took it off of air and put it here.
Okay. That worked. And let's get a sound check on Dave Feliz.
Dave, can you hear yourself okay when you talk?
Hello, yes.
Oh, what a voice. Okay, I think we're really high here.
Okay, so just turn.
1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2.
Dave, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2.
1, 2, 1, 2.
1, 2.
Dave?
1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2.
1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2.
Hello, hello, hello. 1, 2.
How's that, Billy?
This is your volume. You can turn it up or down on your headphones if you want.
Okay, I'm good.
Okay, it looks like we're ready to go.
Okay.
And what I'm going to do. All right.
So you're not going to ask me about salmon, are you?
Yes.
I don't know much about salmon.
Oh.
You don't know much about salmon?
Well, I mean,
that's a perfect
natural history.
That's a perfect excuse to ask you about salmon.
No, there you go.
He's in wildlife and he knows nothing about salmon.
I'm a wildlife guy.
Oh, well, wait a minute. Isn't salmon wildlife?
Yeah.
Technically?
Yeah, fur, feathers, more what a
fur
scales.
Feathers kind of guy, huh?
Well, scales. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Okay, guys.
Thank you, Billy.
You bet.
I'm not sure we can do without you, though, bud.
Something I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, so I need to collapse this a little bit.
So I took a bunch of notes, and then I managed to leave them at home, so I'm...
Well, you know, that's just fine.
Yeah, well...
Because we're just going to have a conversation, and it's a conversation, and it's recorded, so if you say bad words, I can eliminate them. Okay, so 14 is our first one. Get this one. Well, I think we're ready to go, Dave. Are you ready to go?
Yeah, I think so.
I think so. Okay. Okay, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go. A conundrum for those of us who love the... Now I'm going to start that over. Okay, reset. Reset. Okay. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. A conundrum for those of us who love the great outdoors. Much of the wildlands we love traipsing about have been funded by those who love to hunt the wildlife that live on those wild lands. But the numbers of those hunters has been steadily declining for decades, and as their numbers plummet, so does the money they contribute for maintaining the wildlands. And so we ask, what will happen to our wildlife if there are no hunters or fishers?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,184th edition of the Food Chain, or perhaps you're among our friends down there in Tapique, who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What? Well, folks, having been raised in the Big Sky country of Montana, I grew up fishing and hunting. And yes, the family ate pretty much everything we killed. It was not really an elective. It was a necessity. It was good food, and there were a lot of us to feed, and we didn't have a lot of money. I haven't hunted since becoming a Californian, but would if the opportunity presented itself. I do still fish and really love eating the fish I catch. Among the politically correct of the West Coast, and especially of those who are raised on blacktop and concrete, I am probably a little suspect. What? You kill animals and eat them? And you love doing it? How disgusting. That pervasive attitude on hunting and fishing, I suspect, has had a lot to do with the declining numbers of sport hunters and fishers in the past few decades. And those declining numbers present an interesting conundrum for all who love the great outdoors. Hunters and fishers, through the tax dollars of their licensing fees and equipment purchases, pay for much of the conservation of our wildlands and the wildlife that live on those wildlands. In other words, to preserve our wildlife, we must hunt and kill them. Weird, huh? This conundrum leads us to ask, what will happen to our wildlife if there are no hunters or fishers? Who better to ask than Dave Feliz, who is with the California Department of Fish and Game. Dave, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning.
Pleasure to have you aboard. You're a game warden. Are you a game warden?
No, I am not.
You're not? Okay.
I am a senior environmental scientist. I'm the reserve manager of the Elkhorn Slough Reserve.
Okay. Senior environmental science. Boy, you have really a fancy title here.
What does that mean? I've got a huge title there. I'm basically the reserve manager at the Elkhorn Slough.
Okay, good. And for those of us who are listening elsewhere, what exactly is the Elkhorn Slough?
Well, the Elkhorn Slough is a wetland just east of Moss Landing. And it's
right in central California.
Right here in central
California. Right at the mouth of the Monterey Bay.
It's at the heart of the Monterey Bay. And it's about the largest wetland south of San Francisco Bay. And California on our central coast, and it's full of sea otters, harbor seals. It's an important nursery for fish. And on the east side of the slough is the Elkhorn Slough Reserve, and that's the area I manage.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a place that's open for hiking, and we do a lot of environmental education with local school kids. It's a center for research. And stewardship, putting back the habitats, putting them back together after.
So the Elkhorn Slough truly is one of those places that we city people love to get out and traipse about, right?
Absolutely, right. And the reserve is the place where you can do that, where you can actually walk on the trails. There's so few of our wetlands left in California.
What happened to them?
Most of them were developed into marinas. Or used for other purposes, or filled and used for agriculture,
mm-hmm.
and just development of the 20th century.
And now they're gone.
Most of them are gone. But the Elkhorn Slough is a place that took a different path, starting in the probably late 60s, early 70s.
So the fewer of them there are, the more important they become.
Absolutely.
For us to hold on to then.
Absolutely, because they are important stopping points for migratory birds that are moving up and down the Pacific Flyway, so they need a break once in a while, a place to stop, get something to eat, and until they move further south or north.
And because of those birds, the area has become a great attraction for bird lovers.
Absolutely. It's one of the better places on the West Coast of the United States.
I always love to see bird watchers watching birds, because they always stand very attentively with a field glass in one hand,
mm-hmm.
looking and looking and looking and listening.
Right. Yeah. Listening is as important as the looking. And sometimes you need to identify special characteristics.
Okay, well, now I'm going to challenge you a little bit. Some time ago, the California Department of Fish and Game became the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Why the name change?
Yeah, I was going to correct you on that. Yes, we are Department of Fish and Wildlife since 2012. And I think the idea is that we manage more than game animals. We manage all wildlife, including non-game, such as salamanders and insects.
It's probably not big games, those salamanders, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So the idea being then it's not just the game animals or the animals people hunt or fish that you manage. It's the ecosystem in general then.
Absolutely.
That was a pretty big leap of work job title there for the agency, wasn't it?
Yeah, it pretty much captures what we actually do and have been doing for years. So not a whole lot changed with the change of the name. I think it just is a more accurate depiction of what we do. And we essentially manage habitats. And when you manage habitat, you manage all those species that occur in those habitats.
Well, that's a lot of management then.
Yeah, we own about 1 million acres in the state of California that we manage, and as well as being responsible for fish and wildlife resources throughout the state.
And I've come to believe that you're really the king of the roost when it comes to developing anything, because I think you control water, or you manage water resources, right?
The water is managed by the Department of Water Resources and you know, a multitude of water districts. We don't control water. Sometimes there are obligations to maintain fish populations, things like steelhead and our coastal rivers and streams.
Well, I know that when we came to paint the towers at the radio station here, you know, the citizens of the community complained. They accused us of killing fish and stuff like that. So we had all of these government agencies come to visit us. And each one of them said, well, we'll see what Fish and Wildlife have to say. So that's why I came to believe that you're a very powerful agency.
Oh, we are when it comes to, you know, projects that might cause harm to the environment.
Right.
Absolutely. And we are the go-to agency for things like oil spills and pollution spills.
Mm-hmm. Anything that might endanger the wildlife.
Correct.
Okay,
right.
Good.
Or the habitat. So, you know, anything that would impact water quality is definitely going to impact wildlife.
Well, good. Well, I opened with a pretty incredible question, if you think about it. What would happen to our wildlife if there were no hunters and fishers?
Well, the way we're currently set up in this country is most of wildlife conservation is funded through an excise tax on firearms and ammunition. And this has been going since 1937.
That's right. Pretty close to the Great Depression era.
Absolutely. Then. Right. And at that time, the government was seeing dramatic declines in fish and wildlife.
Everybody was eating all the wildlife.
That may have been. And so they imposed this 11% excise tax on firearms and ammunition. Mm-hmm. And so it's everybody that buys guns, including hunters.
Mm-hmm. And going back to those times, I kind of run across that history once in a while. It was tough times for people, very tough times, and it was tough times for animals as well, because they were a food source for a lot of people. And from what I understand, wildlife populations were pretty much decimated by the Great Depression.
Well, I think it was a long decline, you know, starting in the mid-1800s. In California, we just about lost our tule elk within 20 years, and there was a massive market hunting industry to provide food for restaurants, and so people were eating wildlife, starting in the mid-1800s, and all that stopped near the beginning of the 20th century, but but many of those populations needed to recover. What also was happening is habitat was being developed and changed. Wetlands were being drained, and so that was probably the more dramatic or the bigger cause of the decline of those wildlife populations. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily people were eating them, but that their habitat was being destroyed. And, you know, we lost something like 90% of our wetlands in California.
Which is hugely significant. And I remember doing stories about the great duck hunting of the Central Valley, where people would market hunt ducks for sale to the restaurants in San Francisco and whatnot.
Yeah, and I think it's important to recognize that California's Central Valley is unique. There is nowhere like it in the world for waterfowl. And so we currently winter something like 13 million waterfowl in the Central Valley. And nowhere else on earth do you get that concentration of ducks and geese on an annual basis. And so there's been a lot of work done in both the San Joaquin and the Sacramento Valley and the Delta. Mm-hmm. To restore wetlands and to bring back these waterfowl numbers. And they're doing quite well.
And those... waterfowl don't seem to truck along the coast here. They go on the great inland passage through the Central Valley, right?
That's correct. The Central Valley is the destination for many of the waterfowl that are coming from Alaska, Canada, even eastern United States. A big production area is something called the Prairie Pothole Country, which is up in the northern plains of Canada and North America.
You know, I can remember doing a paper route up there in Billings, Montana, getting up very early in the morning. And everything, of course, is very, very quiet, and the air is still and very cold. And I can remember, you know, riding my bicycle around town, delivering papers, and hearing the geese fly over. And it was just, I could almost, you know, feel them up there above me as they kind of flew over and headed one way or another. And so what a pleasure it is to have that wonderful asset here in throughout the country, to be able to find those places where those birds are and just be with them for a little bit, spend some time with them, and through them and through their eyes and through their living experience nature in a way we otherwise wouldn't. And what a blessing it is to have those things around. Michael Olson, this is the Food Chain Radio program today. We're talking with Dave Feliz, who is with the California Department of Food and Wildlife. He is a senior environmental scientist, supervisor, reserve manager, Elkhorn Slough in Central California. And we are with you as well. This is the question of the day is, what will happen to our wildlife if there are no hunters and fishers? Right back. Okay, I'd like to pick up as on the Depression years, and from that, talk about how we rebuilt everything, uh-huh. and into where we are today. But what a fascinating process of rebuilding.
Yeah. I mean, it was really to sort of hasten the decline, and then to start to manage.
Hasten the decline.
Because things were just. We were just losing habitat like crazy.
And
we needed to slow that down and start preserving some areas.
Okay, great.
Managing them.
And let's see. So I have to remember to do this.
How long is your show?
It's an hour long, but it only takes about 45 minutes to record it.
Okay.
You never thought you'd talk for a full hour, right? All right.
Depends how nerdy we want to get.
Uh-huh. Well, to me, it's not nerdy. To me, it's all really interesting stuff, and people don't think about it.
Right.
You know, they don't have the slightest idea what you're out there doing, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, What's Eating What is that we are hunting and fishing our wildlife out there. And because of our hunting and fishing of them, we have the wherewithal to support their environment. And that's the subject of today's show, is what happens if we heed the call of many who suggest that those of us who hunt and fish are crazy, mean, cruel. What happens if we all quit hunting and fishing? Who will then support our wildlife? What do you think? Well, we're here with Dave Feliz, who is with California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and that's what we're talking about today. And when we left off, we were talking a little bit about coming out of the Great Depression, when our environment and our wildlife and everything was pretty much just ravaged, and we had to do something. And so what we did is we start taxing hunters and fishermen. And what did we do from there, Dave?
Well, we actually started taxing the buyers of firearms. So it's the firearms and the ammunition that was being taxed. And, you know, a certain proportion of those were hunters. And what was happening then was wildlife populations were still recovering from the market hunting from the 1800s and the early 1900s. And habitats, wetland habitats and other upland habitats were dramatically in decline. We were developing wetlands. We were draining them.
Pretty much indiscriminately, weren't we?
Pretty indiscriminate. There were no rules to protect habitat. And so we needed to slow that down. And to, if we wanted any chance of preserving some of these wildlife populations. And
now, who was around then to kind of lead that effort? It seemed like Teddy Roosevelt always comes to mind as being one of those characters.
Yeah, Teddy Roosevelt is definitely one of the pillars of conservation. Mm-hmm. Aldo Leopold,
yeah.
And, you know, they sort of signaled that we better do something. And so in 1937, there was a bill passed called, or legislation passed called the Federal Aid in Wildlife Restoration Act. And
37. So, wow, that's just going into the Depression.
Yeah, yeah. And the excise tax apparently existed before that time, but they continued and codified it so it would be there long term. And and so, yeah, it was two congressmen, their names were Pittman and Robertson, so it's called the Pittman-Robertson Act as well, or PR, as we call it in government speak, PR funding. And so the interesting thing is that the tax, it's an excise tax, which means that it happens at the manufacturing stage. And so it's not something that, it's built into the price of these items.
Mm-hmm.
And
so if I were going to go out to buy a handgun just to, you know, protect my home, I would be supporting fish and wildlife.
Yeah. So originally it was just long guns. And and then later on, handguns were added. And at that time, archery equipment was added to the list. And I think that's a 10% excise mm-hmm. tax. And it's mandated that the states have to use it for wildlife and wildlife habitat.
Okay, so this is a federal law mm-hmm. passed by Congress that puts it upon each state to go out and collect these monies. And then does the money go through the government to you, or does it go straight to the state?
It comes through the federal government, and the way it's proportioned is, half is 50% of the funds is based on the land area of the state.
Oh.
And then 50% is based on the number of hunting licenses that they sell. And it mandates that each of the states can only use their hunting license fees for wildlife purposes. They can't use it for something else. And the state has to match 25% of the total. So the total funding, the federal amount is 75%, and the states come up with 25%.
How does California come up with its 25%?
They come up with it primarily through sales of hunting licenses.
Okay.
And then again, they're mandated to only use that money for that purpose.
Okay, so we have the money, thanks to a couple congressmen who put together a law in Washington, D.C. What do we do now? I mean, we have this great devastation of the Great Depression. What do we do now?
Well, the money goes to the states, and they started acquiring land. It can be used for land acquisition, for research, and for management. Also for hunter education is a big part of it, mm-hmm. because that's a recruitment tool to inform people about the safe use of firearms and to teach them about wildlife conservation. And so it's used for those purposes. And so they began purchasing, the states began purchasing land for wildlife areas.
So that must have been an interesting transition to make for hunters who had been used to, you know, being wild and free, to re-educate them, to for them to realize that they're not only out there hunting, but they're conserving too.
Well, there were already regulations that required hunting licenses, and there were regulations regulating the use of wildlife and bag limits and things like that. But it certainly put them in a different light, for sure, that they, you know, that they understood that they were working towards conserving the resources that they were harvesting out.
Kind
in
of
the
an
field.
Existential leap in thinking. When it gets right down to it, you're not only out there shooting animals and eating them, but you're preserving them.
You're providing the habitat that is attracting these animals to you, so you can harvest them. Mm-hmm. And as you said, free range, organic.
There you go, best in the world. Yeah,
exactly.
So, how do you? Is it possible to convince city people of that fact?
Convince them of the fact
of the fact that hunters and fishers are the great conservers of wildlife.
Well, I think it is sort of an untold story. You know, many people don't know where wildlife dollars come from. But the vast majority of conservation dollars is coming from this funding source, mm-hmm. and the same on the fisheries side. There was another act passed called the Sport Fish Restoration Act that taxes fishing equipment and boat fuel, and that provides money for fisheries projects, fisheries habitat projects, and there's a piece of that called aquatic education. Teach people about aquatic habitats, and that's the funding that funds our education program at the Elkhorn mm-hmm. Slough.
Okay, good. So we are fighting for that position in the mind of the public then?
Yes, absolutely. And that's the way it's set up now. And in fact, there were some recent changes to the legislation. A piece was created that was that is going to attempt to recruit and restore and get people re-involved in hunting and fishing. And so there was a grant to that went to all the states to create programs to, you know, to retain hunters so we can maintain it into the future. Hmm. So until we come up with a different funding source, this is it.
So I also know that there are organizations, as the government started trying to get control of the decomposition of our natural resources there at the end of the Depression, were there private organizations that you started working with as well? I'm thinking of organizations like Ducks Unlimited, for example.
Yeah, in recent years, definitely in the last, 30 years or so, 30, Ducks Unlimited is definitely a big partner in restoration projects. I've worked with them on numerous projects. We just finished a wetland restoration project with them at the slough, and called the Hester Marsh. So people might look that up. There's some great video of that project, and so the other organization that is big in our state is the California Waterfowl Association. Mm-hmm. And both of these groups get involved with restoring habitat. We may get federal funding, and we'll turn it over to these guys to restore habitat. Now another way that this works, or one stage in which this works is there's something called the North American Waterfowl Plan. And this is a plan to conserve waterfowl across the country. Mm-hmm. And so important areas are divided up into what are called joint ventures. So there's something called the Central Valley Joint Venture. And so there's funding available through that program. And so if you're in the Central Valley and you can get some funding, that requires some state match, and then we'll turn it over to one of these conservation organizations and work with them to build wetlands.
Well, I first became aware of those organizations when I went back home to Montana once for a family visit and opened up the local newspaper, and there's on the front page was a story about a president of Ducks Unlimited caught with 323 dead ducks in his trunk. I thought, oh, that's what unlimited means, huh? And when I started looking into it, I realized that this is an organization, though some people are a little bit out of bounds there, but it is an organization among many organizations that work to conserve a lot of farmland and habitat and wildlife.
Absolutely. So they either they have a couple of different strategies. One is to acquire land, and then it's usually owned by the state or the federal mm-hmm. government, and then develop habitat on that land and manage wetlands. And most of our wetlands are now managed, are not natural wetlands.
Right.
And the interesting thing in California is that something like 2/3 of the freshwater wetlands in California are in private hands. They're not in government hands. And those private wetlands are mostly duck hunting clubs.
Right.
And so 2/3 of the freshwater wetlands in California are duck hunting clubs providing habitat for wildlife.
So let me ask you this. What would happen if there were no duck hunting clubs?
If there were no duck hunting clubs, there probably would not be as many wetlands, because the government cannot afford to buy all that land, to buy all that water, and to spend the money to manage all those wetlands. So definitely private wetland owners and managers are big partners in this whole story. And I should say that Ducks Unlimited and California Waterfowl Association, they're involved. They do some research. Primarily, it's habitat protection mm-hmm. and creation.
Yeah.
And so when you manage a wetland, you're not only attracting ducks and geese that hunters may go after, but you're attracting shorebirds and neotropical migrants that may be in the willows. So you're really managing a whole ecosystem that's available for a variety of wildlife.
You know, conserving some of that original paradise that was California before
people
showed up.
Sort of, right? Yeah. And you're not really... We're not really recreating the past. It's you know, that would be an impossible task. There's no way
right.
the San Joaquin and Sacramento rivers are going to flood thousands of square miles like they used to. So these happen in managed units, and right. And that costs money. It's hard to get the water. It takes a lot of time. A lot of diesel fuel is spent on tractors managing this habitat. Yeah. But you're providing habitat for a wide variety of species.
Well, now we want to hear about Dave Feliz and how Dave got involved in wildlife management.
Oh, okay.
So, when you were a kid, did you hunt and fish?
No, I did not. Well, I fished. I fished. Uh-huh. I grew up in Southern California, and
not much hunting there.
No, but this was back when you could catch fish at the beach, uh-huh. and certainly spent a lot of time at the ocean. And, I was always interested in the outdoors. And then got interested in photography. And so I started college as a photography major. And then I had the good fortune to spend a couple summers in Yellowstone Park, working. I was working for the concessionaire, but intensified my interest.
Which one, just out of curiosity?
I
grew up there, so.
Oh, where did I work?
Yeah.
Oh, I worked at West Thumb, where there used to be a store on Yellowstone uh-huh. Lake. I worked in a tackle shop.
Okay.
And selling flies and lures to fishermen. So I was, basically a liar. And telling them, depending on which flies we needed to sell. But got very interested in wildlife and changed my major. Went to Humboldt State up in Northwest California. I got a bachelor's degree in wildlife management and started working for Fish and Game in 1984, doing fisheries work, striped bass tagging, and reading striped bass scales and communicating with fishermen.
About. So you're hanging out at the harbor waiting for fishermen to come back with their...
No, I was working in the Delta, and we were... running fike traps and gill nets near Antioch, and then up in the Sacramento River near Clarksburg. And then,
it always seemed like so much fun to me.
Oh, it's a blast! Believe me. Anytime you're in the field doing that, it's a wonderful experience. I mean, there's something primal about putting a net in the water or a trap or something and seeing what you got. And so that's what that was about. It was part of the striped bass studies, and then went on to. Work on state lands beginning in 1988, managing wetlands and building wetlands.
It is primitive, isn't it? You know, you do spend time out there.
Yes, being outdoors, and it is still somewhat mysterious. We don't know everything about these animals, and so there's always surprises and new things to learn.
In your area, Elkhorn Slough, which animal fascinates you most?
Actually, you know, I am fascinated by the fact that we have something like three rare amphibian species that are still persisting there, even though there's hardly any groundwater or any surface water, and these cryptic animals have somehow survived for
millions of
years.
Well, when we come back from this great break, you can tell us about those cryptic animals. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Dave Feliz, California Fish and Wildlife. What will happen to the wildlife of America if there are no hunters and fishermen? Right back. Stay tuned. This business is a little bit like flying an airplane.
Yeah.
When I was a kid growing up in Montana, I learned how to fly airplanes as a way to keep out of jail. And it's a lot like it. Okay.
So probably at some point I want to mention the Monterey Bay Birding Festival.
Well, absolutely.
I'm part of the group that puts that on, and it's coming up.
When is it?
September 20th through the 23rd.
Well, why don't we do a special feature on that? You can call in on the Monday Ag Update, and we can talk about that.
Well, so I also work with Rosie.
Oh, okay,
and,
good.
And talk about
Rosie's
that.
Got that one wired then.
I think so, yeah. I need to... set a date with her.
Okay, so here we go.
20th through the 22nd.
5, 4, 3.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, what we're talking about today is really significant. It's the wildlife that live in our beautiful world here. And, you know, I sometimes think the good Lord made the United States of America as a wildlife paradise because, you know, when we first showed up here, there were the great herds of buffalo. And here in Central California, when the rains would come, the whole valley would flood and turn into this migratory paradise for cajillions of birds and wildlife, and then so we showed up on the scene and trounced about and developed everything we could, and we took that piece of the Bible that says take dominion of everything, but we used that, we came to think of that dominion as something that we own. We can use it for whatever we want. But really, dominion means taking responsibility. And how do you take responsibility? Well, one way is you establish some organizations that are responsible for that. And how do you fund them? Well, one way you fund them is by charging those who love to hunt and fish a fee for that privilege, and using that money to take dominion. And that's what the California Department of Fish and Wildlife does, is take dominion. Is that right, Dave?
Yes.
Exactly right.
I have not used the word dominion myself, but yes.
But that's what you do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you met before the break, you mentioned that there are three species out there at the Elkhorn Slough that exist apart from the waters of that slough?
Yes. The Elkhorn Slough area still has a lot of good oak woodlands, and in these woodlands, there's some species of amphibians that are pretty rare in California, and they're still surviving out there. They include the Santa Cruz long-toed salamander, the California tiger salamander, and the red-legged frog.
Now, what makes you think them so special? I mean, a lot of people curse the salamander for preventing the building of developments and whatnot. And Dave Feliz says these are very special. Why?
Well, these animals have evolved to live here over millions of years. And they do things that we don't quite understand. They may have properties or behavior we don't know about yet. And there may be ways that we benefit from these animals, like we benefit from everything else in nature. Basically, everything we need has come from nature. It seems important to have all the pieces in place so they can continue to function in a relatively healthy ecosystem, functioning ecosystem. And because these are resources that may be important to us in the future, or they may, many of us feel they're important just for their own intrinsic value.
So the short answer is we really don't know why we want to preserve these insignificant, tiny little critters, but we know we better.
I think we better, yeah. Absolutely. Oh. And, you know, the Elkhorn Slough is located in a place of really unparalleled diversity. You know, nearby is redwood forests above Watsonville, and the beautiful oak woodlands and grasslands and tidal marshes and mudflats. And then right offshore is a deep Monterey canyon. And the upwellings that creates, the deep sea life in there. And everything that is attracted to that canyon because of the currents that are coming up from the depths, which brings lots of food, lots of bait fish, which brings whales, which brings seabirds, all in a very close proximity. Something like over 300 species of birds can be seen within a 10-mile radius of Moss Landing, which is pretty remarkable anywhere, you know, compared to other places of the country.
You know, I did not realize, not being a native or a native fisherman here in the area, how significant the fisheries are in this area until I was fishing for the giant halibut up in Alaska. And the boat captain was, and I were talking, and he said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Oh, down the Monterey Bay area." And he said, "Wow, that place is incredible." And it is, mm-hmm. because of that canyon out there. Big difference. So what about your job? You're kind of like the chief law enforcement officer, right?
Well, I'm not in law enforcement. I'm in land management. We have a law enforcement division.
Okay.
So those are the game
wardens.
So you
don't carry a gun in arrest?
I don't carry a gun. No, those are the game wardens do. And they are the most highly trained, highly educated peace officers in the state. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they require some college credits to be a game warden, mm-hmm. some intense training, and, you know, those guys can do it all.
So what kind of things do people want to poach from your neck of the woods?
Oh, in the Elkhorn Slough? Yeah. Well, the Elkhorn Slough is part of a marine protected area. So parts of the slough are not open for any sort of fishing.
Okay.
Other parts are. And so enforcing those sorts of regulations, people fishing in the wrong place, people taking too many fish, is something they would look into. Our folks are probably on site this morning because a vehicle was overturned in the slough in Moss Landing this morning. Highway 1 is a mess, and so
we love our California traffic. Nobody does it better, right?
Right. But because of vehicles in the slough, our Office of Oil Spill Response folks, OSPR, are on scene.
Well, what kind of fun adventures do you have, Dave Feliz?
Well, at this point in my career, I do a lot of email, and I talk on the phone a lot, and I talk to people a lot. But I do try to stay involved with our environmental education programs, mm-hmm. and because we have a lot of school kids that come out, I like talking to them about reptiles and about birds and about wildlife.
Do you talk to them about the importance of hunting and fishing?
at time with the older.
This is a real tough issue to put on the table for kids. You know, I mean, the importance of hunting and fishing as a way of saving what we're doing here, and not only of getting the cash, but those wildlife populations must be managed somehow. Am I wrong?
That's correct. Yeah, it's definitely one of the lessons is that wildlife requires management these days because
you can't just let the populations run amok.
Because we've restricted them to very limited areas, and so those areas we need to maximize wildlife populations, well, manage or maximize diversity as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I think with the older kids, definitely we tell them where that money comes from,
mm-hmm.
and with adults. And I think that you know it's important that everybody understand that because wildlife is really a nonpartisan issue, and most people want to support wildlife, and it's a good point of conversation.
Do you think we're losing that battle, or the hunters and fishermen are losing that battle? I think so.
Losing the battle of
the public perception. You know, if I were to walk out in the street and strike up a conversation with just about anybody and confess to be a hunter.
Oh, I
they would probably look at me.
Yeah, it depends how much they know. So you're doing a great service here to get the word out. And, you know, one way that that hunters also contribute is by the purchase of duck stamps, federal duck stamps and state duck stamps, which are required. It's required that they purchase them in order to hunt waterfowl or upland game.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody can purchase those stamps, and collectors will purchase them. And they're quite beautiful. There are, you know, national and statewide art contests to decide which artwork will be on those stamps. Mm-hmm. So buying a duck stamp, either state or federal, is a good way for anybody to contribute.
So going back to that public education, you know, and facing the children that come to visit you and your wonderful facilities, you know, they're looking at all of this beautiful nature, and to give them an understanding of how it's made possible. So you have to come to grips with the fact that they need to know.
Yeah, I think it depends on how old the kids are. Okay. I mean, we're trying to get them to understand the concepts of ecosystems,
mm-hmm.
and the concepts of how we impact the function of those systems, how their lives impact the function of those systems, and how they can change that or better them.
So this would be a really tough one, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And how you stand up and say, you know, what needs to be said without offending, because you will offend.
Oh, I think with kids, you're not really offending, but with some adults,
teachers, probably.
I think they're, I don't know that they're offended, but they're surprised. And because, again, it's an untold story, and there's no reason to be offended by it, because we all impact the environment in our lives, and you know, and hunters are instead of going to the supermarket, they are getting food out mm-hmm. in the field, and again, free range organic.
And not only are they getting food for themselves, but they're helping to preserve the environment.
Absolutely,
and they're helping to manage the wildlife population.
Right. And they're also contributing towards education, because some of that goes to hunter education, which includes conservation education, and fishermen are contributing to aquatic education. And so they're contributing to people knowing more about their local environment.
Is anybody taking up the mantle for hunters and fishermen in the environment? Can you think of, I mean, is the National Rifle Association right now is so set on defending itself for the Second Amendment. I don't see it defending hunters and fishermen. Who is, or is anybody?
Oh, I think the Fish and Wildlife agencies are, both the state agencies and the federal agencies. Ducks Unlimited, absolutely. They're on both sides, if there are two. There really are not sides, but they are far-reaching. It's the same with the California Waterfowl Association. They're involved in education, and they're involved in habitat management of multiple species.
Mm-hmm.
And
so, do they do public educate? I'm trying to think of what I've seen from the Ducks Unlimited. I think I see mostly they focus on wildlife preservation. This is what we do: we preserve land, right?
Mm-hmm. And and
embedded, but does anybody stand up and say, "Hey, hunters and fishers are needed"?
Oh, I see those organizations doing that.
They do
quite a bit. Yeah, okay, absolutely. Good. Yeah, I mean, because again, that's the primary funding source, and we haven't come up with anything else. Other states have come up with taxes that go to wildlife preservation.
Mm-hmm.
I think Kansas comes to mind.
Yeah, but not California.
That has not happened here. No. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's important for people to realize that your tax dollars are not necessarily going towards wildlife, that only if you are buying a hunting or fishing license or firearms. Then
only if you're participating,
right,
are you protecting.
Right. Now, there's other ways, certainly.
You could donate money, I suppose.
Donate money to nonprofits that are preserving land in our area. The Elkhorn Slough Foundation, mm-hmm, is a land trust in the Elkhorn Slough watershed, protecting lands that that may have some farming activity that could pollute the slough, and so they're acquiring and cleaning up some of those operations,
mm-hmm,
and so contributing to those sorts of organizations is helps wildlife as well.
Good, but
so there's multiple ways to contribute, but as far as a statewide system, no. I mean, there was an attempt about 10 years ago to put a tax on vehicle registration, but it wasn't passed by the voters.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned getting into all of this by getting into photography.
Mm-hmm.
And if you love to go out and take pictures of nature, your vision is focused. You start looking at things and seeing things and paying attention to
absolutely
things. And in that observation, becoming more keenly tuned in to life and what's going on around you. And hunting and fishing are certainly that in essence, when you start looking and hunting and seeing things.
I think that in those activities, you're even going beyond that, and you're taking on a role, the role of a predator.
Yes.
In the field, and trying to outsmart, a pintail that may have flown 2,000 miles to get to your place, and you want him to land within 100 feet of where you're sitting, and they're pretty wary. So yeah, it does take some skill and some, a lot of insight to understand how to do that.
A lot of smarts, right?
Yes.
And are you a duck hunter?
I am not.
You're not?
No.
Are you a hunter of anything?
I do not hunt. No.
Not hunt.
I fish locally. Yes. I try to surf fish up in Zumdowski and some other places.
Uh-huh. And that's kind of fun too, right?
Absolutely.
So, my goodness, what fun. Dave Feliz. So, how would you recommend young people get involved in fish and wildlife? Come for a visit, right?
Oh, absolutely, but, come for a visit to the Elkhorn Slough Reserve, where you can hike up to 5 miles of trails, spend time outdoors, learn all you can. There's lots of lectures in our area.
So, do you think hunting and fishing will survive?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely.
Okay, there's the good news. Thank you so much, Dave Feliz, for joining us. And thank you all for tuning in. The Food Chain Radio program, really appreciate it. And see you next week.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.